Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stayed glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis. And on this episode, we take a look at what may be one of Don Bluth's best films he ever did. It also happens to be one of his more later films as far as his production company and his empire that he built through the 80s and 90s. In a certain way. Of course, he'd have one more big film after this. Titan A, which I actually think is a good film. Maybe talk about that later. I'm, of course, talking about 1997's Anastasia. Done, of course, with his partner, Gary Goldman, in conjunction with Fox Animation Studios in their attempt to, you know, battle the juggernaut that is Walt Disney Animation Studios. So, all that and more here on episode 106 of the Prerogative. As I said, Anastasia, 1997, one of Don Bluth's final films in a way. I mean, not his last, like I said, he did Titan A. And again, a lot of people, it has gotten mixed reviews. And yeah, I'm just confirming it. Yeah, Titan A really was his last, like, major film role as a director. I mean, he had some other thing. He'd gone back to Dragon's Lair and done some other video game music video segment. But really, Titan A ended up being his really last big major film that he really produced. Or should say, directed. So this is the second to last. So one of the last. I actually think Titan A gets a bad rap. I actually, for the most part, enjoyed it as a science fiction flick. I actually haven't watched it in years. Maybe I should make that one of my assignments. I've been thinking about doing a Don Bluth month. Because, you know, I want to review that. I want to review, you know, Rock-A-Doodle-Doo. I want to review Secret of Nim. I do want to do a Don Bluth month. I know... Mean Gene has been begging for me to do a Don Bluth month. I've heard him once or twice say I should do. Which did kind of lead to this, is I have been wanting to do a Don Bluth film, you know, and I was searching for films that really have either Christmas or winter theme. And Anastasia was one of the ones that came up. You know, strangely enough, you think about winter with this film because it starts off in Russia and, there really isn't anything Christmas-related about this movie. About the only thing winter-related is at the beginning of the movie where, the, you know, it's Russia and everything's cold and there's snow everywhere. sort of the same reason why I took Pebble and the Penguin as a December movie to review, in a way, which is probably horrible of me. But at the same point in time, this is a wonderful movie that I've been... Again, it's another movie I've been searching for the right time to review. And honestly, you know, how many Christmas and holiday specials can you review? You know, this is going to be a really interesting month. You know, I'm going to be reviewing this. You know, I have a very special surprise I'll reveal at the end of the podcast of what I'm reviewing next week, because it's actually something I've really never done with this podcast as far as topics, and I would hope that you will indulge me on this. Well, I have reviewed something like it. You'll see when I review it. But I think, you know, again, it's my podcast, and I like going back into retro, so we'll get to that when we get towards the end. I want you to stick to the end to hear what it is. And I do plan on actually reviewing, by at the end of the month, Tokyo Godfathers. Before I take about a week break, as I prepare for the epicness that I hope to be able to do in January. I have some plans. I have not discussed those plans with some people that I want to bring on. If one person's listening, yes, I do want to talk about a certain group of shows that a certain person who listens to the show has been asking for me to review. I'm certainly going to want to go towards that. Because again, I've been waiting for the right time to do that. You know, I always have plans. Everybody has plans. They have plans. But nobody knows what to do with those plans. But all of a sudden, I've started channeling Heath Ledger. Joker. I have no idea why. Anyways, back to Anastasia. Like I said, it's a film I very much look forward to. It was probably the best animated film of 1997. I'm trying to remember, what was the Disney film that came out at the time? Mulan, if I remember right, Mulan was 98. I want to say it was 98. Trying to remember what was 97. Was 97 Hercules? I thought 96 was Hercules. I'm completely blanking off my, you know, off the top of my head. Please, guys, help me if I am right. Maybe a better way to look is the Annie Awards. As we go here, best animated film. Nope, not telling me. Or I could just look here. Or that doesn't work. Anyways, I'm completely blanking on the Disney film as that came out at this time. Who cares? Hi, man. Take her easy. But at the same point in time, you know, it was one of those films that captured the world's attention again. Going after the classic fairy tale that was Anastasia. I don't know if kids today really understand why it kind of was a fairy tale. Because it still was a bit of a fairy tale that was, you know, the idea of the long lost daughter of the last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, the last of the Romanovs. So for people who maybe not heard the tale, it's a folklore that one of the youngest children of Nicholas II, the last of the Romanovs, who was captured in the Russian Revolution, and the entire family was eventually killed. The folklore and the legend and fable, as it was for years, was that one escaped and had secretly went to hiding and lived her life, and the family did continue. It's been kind of proven that, yeah, it's just folklore, and that unfortunately, sadly, the women and children were massacred by the Reds when the whites were coming. It's a very sad story. But there, out of this came this legend that one survived, one got away. Hence, to which a play was developed, in which a 1956 live-action film was based off of, which this animated film is based off of as well. Another unique thing about this film, and again, like I said, this is being distributed by 20th Century Fox under Fox Animation Studios, which Don Bluth and Gary Goldman became a part of. You know, in a way, this was Fox trying to compete with Disney, which they failed at miserably. And, you know, the other thing I think that's really unique about this film is really this is our first look at really what Don Bluth would have done with a princess musical. Now, I know on a very technical level he did Thumbelina, and again, which also features the voice of Judy Benson as Thumbelina. And I kind of enjoyed that movie. But I don't know. It had... I'm very hesitant to call any movie that features songs by fucking Barry Manilow a fucking musical. But then again, why do I still consider Pebble and the Penguin a musical? So I guess in a very technical level, this isn't the first, you know, Don Bluth film. Not saying this is the first Don Bluth musical or anything, but this is not the... I was going to sit here and say, I was like, oh man, I'm going to be able to sit here and say that this is the first, you know, Don Bluth princess musical film. And then, nope. That was Thumbelina. So this is his second princess musical film, and a much better idea at what Don Bluth would have done with, you know, if he had still been working with Disney and worked on the likes of Beauty and the Beast and, you know, Little Mermaid and Jazz in Aladdin. And, you know, the tales that basically made Disney the ton of money that it has, so we can, you know, buy Marvel, buy Disney, and, you know, put out 5 different versions of a CG animated movie that basically makes fun of the entire company. Yeah, no. All those things that Disney gets to do today because of those great films, yeah, this is really a picture at, you know, what one of those films would have been like if directed by Don Bluth. And, you know, Don Bluth, you know, really was the main rival of Disney. You know, people can point to MGM Grand, you know, for these films, including Pebble and the Penguin, you know, Fox here, and there had been some other animated studios, but the main rival really came from Don Bluth. Don Bluth animated films were the main rivalry for the Walt Disney Animated Studios, and by far, in particular, starting in that really in 1989 and going onward, Disney was kicking his ass. But there was a time there where really the better films were from Don Bluth. When you think about American Tale, and you think about Secret of Nim, and other films that came out in the 80s. I mean, Don Bluth got his start at Disney. You know, he worked on Sleeping Beauty. He worked on Robin Hood, and he worked on The Rescuers, among other things, before him and others, so-called defected Disney, to head out on their own, but made some great stuff, and so many classic animated film series, all which would forget sequels. So again, it's not just Disney that does the sequel machine, mind you. But, you know, Secret of Nim and American Tales, Land Before Time, All Dogs Go to Heaven. With others we've mentioned. So, you know, it is part of this interesting thing that this list is basically 20 years almost of Don Bluth, or more than maybe 17, 18 years. But still, this a large amount of time of Don Bluth being this major rival, mind you, to Disney, and it's not until 1997, okay, technically 1995 with Thumbelina, but as far as seeing a good example of it, not till 1997 that we finally get to see what Don Bluth and his staff would really do, doing what made Disney Disney with the princess musical. And by no means do I think this is a bad attempt at that. So, why don't you say we take a look into all of this? We have so much to talk about. We have songs I'll talk about, and I'll probably go into some rant about Frozen about that. It's as if I've, you know, before recording, I've at least attempted to practice, you know, what I was going to say. So we have that. We have animation. We have voice acting. You have story. So let's go into what, of course, that means first. Let me give you a little synopsis. If you've never seen Anastasia, and there will be spoilers in this review, but let's go over our synopsis. The year is 1916, and Nicholas II is celebrating the Romanov tricentennial with his mother, the Tsar Empress Maria Feodora, and of course his family, which includes his precious little Anya. When the evil sorcerer Rasputin comes barging into the ball and puts a curse on the Romanov family when they're using a secret magical thing, thingamadig, that, you know, he sold his soul for so he could throw the curse. This curse, of course, sparks the Russian Revolution, leading to the royal family having to attempt to escape Russia. And, of course, during this, Rasputin drowns in the Icy River and trying to drag Anastasia down with him. And just as though Maria and Anastasia think they're about to escape, Anastasia falls off the train and falls seemingly unconscious on the snow as her grandmother unfortunately rides away in a train. Cut to 10 years later, and Russia's under a communist rule where apparently red ink gives you freedom and blue ink gets you thrown in the baggage car. The train car set on fire and sent barreling down a ravine. There are two con artists in St. Petersburg by the name of Dmitry and Vladimir who are attempting to search for an Anastasia lookalike to pass off to the Grand, the Taoist Empress Maria Feodora and collect her reward of 10 million rubles for her, which is being awarded for a safe return. At the same point in time, a young urchin orphan by the name of Anya leaves and decides to strike on her own. Of course, they meet, and of course, the beach again. Vladimir can't help but notice just how much Anya looks like the lost Princess Anastasia. They convince her that she might be it, of course, with their plans, of course, being just to pass her off in an attempt to collect the reward. And all three head towards Paris to meet the Empress. Of course, while this is going on, Rasputin is awakened by the fact that one Romanov lives, and he will not rest in peace until the last of the Romanovs is dead. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Anastasia. Heart, don't fail me now. Courage, don't desert me. Don't turn back now that we're here. People always say life is full of choices. No one ever mentions fear or how a road can seem so long, how the world can seem so vast. Courage, see me through. Heart, I'm trusting you on this journey. Welcome back. You know, it was really hard to choose which music song because, you know, there are three great songs I could have used to represent this movie. Which brings up a good talking point, which I'll talk about in a second. I do want to say, by the way, while we were at break, I did look up the list of Walt Disney animation movies, which, to break the fourth wall, you know, had I been during my younger podcast years, I would like, oh no, I gotta find out now. Like, okay, who am I kidding? That would have been last week. But somehow I was able to keep my composure and wait till break. It was Hercules that came out in 1997. That was the Disney movie. You know, I always forget that 1993 was sort of the year without a Disney movie. Because there were none. Or at least none from Walt Disney Animation Studios, but really that was the only Walt Disney Animated Studios. I think that may have been also the year of Toy Story, though. Okay, we're not here to talk about Disney. We're here to talk about Anastasia, and we're here to talk about its music. And like I said, you know, it was very hard to pick which song to put there. I ended up going with Journey to the Past by Aaliyah, or at least the version sung by Aaliyah. Which, of course, that song, along with the entire score, would be nominated for Oscars and Globe and Globes. Unfortunately, would lose to Titanic in my Huntsville Dolphin. I still hate Celine Dion to this day. Okay, I hate Celine with the one exception of the Beauty and the Beast song with Pumbleton for Beauty and the Beast. That's like her only one good hit. Rest of her is fucking crap. Goddamn Canada. As I now look at Titanic, Frozen in 1998. You know, I kind of find it funny. And this is one thing to bring up with the songs right away, actually, is, you know, there was actually a news article about Frozen, to where apparently the director, she is apologizing for to people everywhere for Let It Go, because it's now become this annoying piece of goddamn, oh my god. So anytime anybody says Let It Go, everybody starts going, Let It Go, Let It Go. Stop fucking my brain to pieces. And I made the offhand comment, looking at offhand comment, the snippy, snarky comment, I'll admit it. Because, yes, Edwin, I do have a lot of vitriol towards Frozen. Again, I would point you to my review with Chris on Frozen that I did about middle of it, earlier this year. Way earlier this year. You know, last April. But I bring this up because I made the comment basically that, well, maybe if it had some better songs to stand back on, you know, instead of all the crappy songs that the soundtrack was a part of, you know, maybe it would be looked at with more favorably and wouldn't be such a played out, oh my god, please stop singing this, I'm going to hunt down the composer and kill him type of song. And I was hoping people would get what I was saying, just like I hope people would get what I was saying in the review, but of course I know people didn't. You know, and look, if you like the music, you like the music. The reason I'm bringing it up here is the point I was trying to make is that Let It Go, while a good song, is a song with no other songs to fall back on to support it. You know, yes, I know people like Do You Want to Build a Snowman? But It and Open Up the Window, as I've said before, is technically the same song and telling the same story. It's just that they just have slightly different melodies, but they're the same song. We're not even going to talk about the stupid goddamn dating song, whatever it's called. You have the Snowman song, which completely seems like it belongs nowhere in this movie. And it's just a fun song for kids. You have the Fixer Upper, which, again, seems like from a different movie. Really, the only other good, like I said, the only other good song in the movie is the opening ice song, sung by the Ice Makers. I bring this up because what Anastasia has, as far as the songs, is it has two show-stopping numbers. One that, an ending theme that's a show-stopping number, but you have these two great songs that play off of each other, you know, and more importantly, have supporting songs to back up and continue the story, and every song tells a different part of the story. Again, this is not just a Disney thing. You know, everybody always, you know, any time I hear anybody try to, you know, take sort of my side, not that I'm the main person who's come up with it, but some people with similar opinions as long as the music, and they've always tried to use Disney. And there's always been a back and forth there. But here, I think, is a perfect example of something that's non-Disney that's doing the same thing and showing, again, here is proof, fact of it. You know, you have, in a way, you have Journey to the Past and Once Upon a December. Both, in a way, are talking about the same topic, but they are vastly different and telling different stories. Journey to the Past is a wonderful, beautiful song about, you know, finding her way. You know, I know there's somebody out there for me. I know my family's out there for me. And one day, I'm going to find them. A very hopeful song. Journey to the Past, well, yes, in a way, they have sort of the same topic of Anya trying, telling us part of the story of Anya trying to find her past. Well, Journey to the Past is this hopeful, you know, I know somebody's there waiting for me. Once Upon a December is telling of those memories that she knows she has. She talked about lightly her memories and Journey to the Past, but Once Upon a December is more of an invasion of those memories as she's now in a setting that is familiar, but she just can't remember. So that once up a December. Da, 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 da. And again, the melodies are also very different. The use of the music, the tones, the minor keys, the minor and major key, you know, both are in major form. But the way they play, you know, someone holds me safe and warm. Now she's turned to a silver storm. Someone hanging over me across my memories. Long ago, burning dim as an ember. Years to know, once upon a December. I don't know why I felt the need to sing that, which I guess in one way shows you just how great these songs are. It's again, everybody knows these songs. Everybody knows Journey to the Past. Everybody can instantly remembers Once Upon a December. It's not just the show-stopping numbers, but there are these great songs. And of course, the third song I mean mentioned to before, the ending theme is back at the beginning, Richard Marx and Donna Lewis, which is just a wonderful, it's one of my favorite Richard Marx songs, by the way. It's definitely my favorite duet that he's done. I am a big Richard Marx fan. Look, that may be, make me a douchebag, but I don't give a damn. I also do like Bryan Adams. Yes, I guess this says a lot about me and my taste in music, so you go to hell. But the other thing to bring up here is then you have the supporting songs that do support these titles. And what, yes, the two big songs probably in the movie themselves are back-to-back. Like I said, they tell the same story, and also Once Upon a December and Journey Through the Past throughout the film are used on a thematic note throughout the score, which we'll get to in a second. But then you have a lot of the supporting songs. These, a lot of these are fun and great songs that tell unique parts of the story, that continue the story. And they have the great same thematics. One thing to talk about score and about the music is there the great use of sort of classic Eastern European instruments and that Eastern European sound, the bells. Oh god, I wish I would know the instruments, but there are certain instruments they're definitely using that are of Russian and that Eastern European sound. You know, have, you know, Rumor in St. Petersburg, a great little romp song. You know, you're shown the basically the Russian Revolution, you cut to 10 years later. And it's this great little song. And if, you know, this and the Perry song. I'm looking at the soundtrack now. By the way, it was at the beginning. Paris Holds the Key to Your Heart and Rumor in St. Petersburg are straight up musical numbers. Yeah, they with these with a lot of these dancers, like, you can see how this is staged. You can see the stage performance part of it, but the songs themselves work very well. And they have, again, they continue the thematic notes, you know, the opening heart, the heart of the past, the rumor in St. Petersburg or something that happened long ago, keeping those thematic points and telling a certain part of the story. Oh, In the Dark of the Night. Oh my god. Okay, fourth show-stopping number. This is a great villain song. And, you know, the interesting part is not sung by Christopher Lloyd, the voice actor, but sung by Jim fucking Cummings. A man who, you know, I've stated it, deserves to be on that Mount Rushmore of great voice actors. My god, he sings the song wonderful. And it's this great show-stopping villain song that has this sort of, like, there's this, I think what makes it work is this point of cheerfulness within the song. You know, he's talking about these despicable things, and there's a sense of cheerfulness. It's a very, you know, it's... I almost want to compare it to American Psycho, in a way, to, you know, of course, the very famous scene to where, you know, Christian Bale's character is preparing to kill the guy, and he's dancing, and he's got the screen that's showing the movie, and he's imitating the movie, and everything, this very, this cheerfulness to right before he basically cuts a guy's head off and fucking butchers him with an axe. It's that same type of feeling in this song. It's glorious in its villainy, and I love it. It's like, and again, it tells a story, and it tells a different part of the story that I think lends itself to the lesson and morale tale of this movie. In this case, that part is, you see Rasputin 10 years later, he still can't let go of the past. Again, we'll talk more about this sort of connection later when we get to story. Again, I'll be talking about songs more again when we get to that part. Then you learn to do it. Which, again, this fun song, and it's this great supporting song that continues the story. And the thing about all these songs is all these songs work well off each other, and they continue the story that each song is telling, and they support each other. And which was the point I was trying to make about the Frozen songs, is that none of the songs really support each other. They're there, and they're standoff, and you may like them, but they don't really continue the story. Here you have this group of songs. Each one is telling a part of the story, and it continues on. And again, this is what Beauty and the Beast did, what Little Mermaid did, what Aladdin, all the great Disney films did. It's what this new revamped style of the musical, revamped by Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, does best. And each one works well off of each other. So, overall, I love the songs. I think they're all great. They're all fun. Obviously, there are those that stand out, like In the Dark of the Night. Once Upon a December is just mind-blowingly amazing. Of course, including the visuals that go with it. We'll get into animation in a little bit. And, of course, Journey to the Past... Wow. You know, I love Journey to the Past. I love Aaliyah's version of it. To the point to where Journey to the Past inspired an entire movie idea for me. You know, I was thinking about this in preparation, and it actually made me go back and look up. I know it's because I have this thing of, like, movie ideas I have, and, like, going all the way back, this, like, movie idea I came up with in, like, the mid-thousands. I had this idea for this sort of final fantasy-like musical. Basically, the story is that, you know, a kingdom is attacked, and princess and a knight that's charged with guarding her are exiled, and it's like 15 years later, and the princess has grown, and she and the knight are on their way back to try to find allies for the kingdom, and along their journey, they run into these two orphans who have decided to strike it out on their own. Of course, these two buddy cops, one was black, one was white. This was my, as a the best way to call it, my ghetto phase. And I was really inspired by things like Exit Wounds and things like that. And so it was like that, you know, streetwise, ghetto kids, to, you know, play comedy type of thing. Best way I can explain it. But one of the things, reasons that inspired this was, you know, it, idea for there to be a musical. And in turn, the really the first big song would be, technically, Journey to the Past. And I envisioned Journey to the Past being this, not duet. I can't remember what the word is for it. I think trio is the word, but I think there's maybe another word for it. But basically, you have three people singing the song. I mean, the first verse says, the first group of verses along with the first chorus song sung by the princess, and then the second group of verses and chorus line split between the two guys, with the third one being sung by all three. So that's how much this, I think that this song, how great I think it is, and how much it's actually personally inspired. Inspired? I think I said that right. Inspired me. On a imaginatory and intellectual level, as far as inspiring me for ideas of stories. So, it's just a wonderful song. It's got great musical notes. I think that's a great way to segue into score as well. I find the score to be great. The score is composed by David Newman of the Newman film. Newman family, excuse me. Actually, his father, Alfred Newman, composed the score of the 1956 film. And, of course, David's cousin. I believe it's cousin. Let me just double-check on that. Yeah, he is. Cousin. He is the cousin of Randy Newman, you know, famed composer of Pixar. Again, I go back to this. One thing that I liked that he did was he kept a lot of thematical notes from the big two songs, you know, of Journey to the Past and Once Upon a December, because throughout the movie, there are segments where you hear these little reprieve thematical notes played from those songs. With Once Upon a December played in a lot of scenes where she's starting to remember. And towards the end of the film, where it gets a bit more brighter and discovered, definitely uses a lot of thematic notes of Journey to the Past. So you have that. And overall, the score is really well done. I love the score, in particular, of the train scene. It's tense and everything you want in an action scene as far as the score is done. Another great score that I think he does in this film is the boat scene. Again, I think one thing he did really well was really score the action scenes as a whole well. Because the final fight I thought was scored well. I thought the boat where she's daydreaming and you have the score that's flipping back and forth between the real world and this dramatic this storm that's raging outside. And at the same time, you had then switching back to, you know, Anya's dream to where she's dreaming of these people in this warm spring place. So overall, I thought the score was absolutely fantastic. They had really good job scoring this film. And I think, again, the score was nominated for an Oscar for a reason because it's done really, really well. It is funny because, again, if there is one criticism, is that I think sometimes he tends to overuse those thematic notes from Once Upon a December and Journey to the Past. He uses it, I think, one time, a couple times too many. Because it just seems like he's going back to it. And this is really the first, like, okay, I now see what people say when they say he's scoring the same song. Because they'll throw in those thematic notes from those songs, like, randomly into certain parts of the score. Like, you'll have this one part of the score going, and all of a sudden here's this part that's very... It's that magical note little thing from Journey to the Past or Once Upon a December, and then it'll go back to that score. But outside of that, that's really being nitpicky. I love the score. let's move on to animation. And overall, there's a there's that classic Don Bluth style, but there's a bit more softness to it. Is I think the best way I can describe it is that this is classic Don Bluth art style, but with a bit of softness and almost, I dare say, watercolor and sort of inspired impressionism, considering the age and obviously they're drawing influence from as they're going to like the early 1900s. So on a time, I want to say a time of the impressionists. I know it, you see a bit of surrealism in there as well. But definitely to what I feel is the time, because I'm looking at it now, saying it brought to the Prime Minister 1870s, 1880s, Claude Monet. I mean, particularly when they get to France, you see that, and you see things of like the some of the surrealists. I'm actually looking at a picture now, and that same type of softness in this picture I'm seeing is there as well. It's definitely impressionist. And again, I'm going more into probably thinking of that Perry song. You know, Paris holds the key to your heart. Because there's definitely a lot of different artistic styles used in that segment. But for a majority of the film, I think the best way to describe it is it's Don Bluth, but a bit softer. Which, you know, again, it was a little change that made the film extremely unique artistically, I think, from other Don Bluth films. Because when you look at Thumbelina and you look at Rock-a-Doodle-Doo and Pebble and the Penguin and, you know, Land Before Time and American Tales, and all of this have this very distinct Don Bluth style. And it's like, it's distinctly Don Bluth. It's the best way to describe the overall style. But this is a film that was very vastly different. And of course, probably a lot of that had to do with the fact that you were dealing with humans as opposed to the animals that Don Bluth usually deals with. But at the same point in time, you know, here, it's also different when you look at Titan AE, which has a different style as well. Here, again, like I said, the best way to describe it is it's classic Don Bluth, but softer. It's a softer version of Don Bluth is maybe the best way to encapsulate all of it. I think the best way to see all of this is in the character designs. I love the character designs. I think they all work well. Starting off with Anya. You know, Anya, I love her. You know, again, the slim, you know, she looks like somebody who's been from an orphanage, and yet there's this radiant beauty that actually comes from inside. That's best seen when she finally is put in the dresses towards the end of the film and she's in these dresses. There's a radiant beauty that comes from inside that comes out in her dresses. It's not her body that's making her dresses. It's her radiant beauty. And I think that's something that Don Bluth and his animators caught perfectly in this film with this character design. It wasn't this... Again, very athletic body, so I love that design. I love the showcase of the radiant beauty being inside. I think the red hair was a great choice. Reddish brunette hair was a great choice. Dimitri as sort of that classic sort of chiseled, I don't want to say chiseled, but that very sort of good-looking Prince Charming character, I thought was a good choice. Again, you can see a bit of Aladdin in that character design in a way, which I actually liked. He was definitely like saying, "This is Tom Cruise." Vladimir had this round, classic round Disney warmth to him that I loved. You could say the same thing about Pooka. Pooka was classic Don Bluth animal design. And then you have Rasputin's design. I love the color scheme on Rasputin with the greens and the blacks. And I think his colors in the grays. With the grays also, the color scheme works very, very well. Very much enjoyed it. Then you have Bodok. Or Botok. Excuse me. a Bartok, excuse me, who somehow steals the fucking movie. I still haven't figured this out. Don't get me wrong, Hank Azaria is good in this role. I still haven't fucking figured out how fucking Bartok steals this fucking movie and needs a fucking prequel film. But, you know, definitely it's a unique design because, okay, you have this funny, cute-looking bat. But let's make him white and make him really stand out. Because that's the thing about Bardock and why he stands out so much is that there's a lot of earthy tones and classic European sort of almost dirty tones to it. And so there's a very down-to-earth feel to all the designs, even the animals. And yet then you have this one character who's like all white and really stands out from the rest of the movie. And so it was definitely a unique design choice, one that I think works. So all in all, I thought the entire character designs worked really, really well. And then you have the action animation, which I thought was extremely done well. You know, in particular when you look at that train scene and the way, you know, you can see the gears moving the train as it's moving out of control and the sparks flying everywhere. There's a lot of great sort of that tension in the action scenes where, you know, you feel tense through watching it and you feel the drama coming out of it. There's a lot of sort of soul in those scenes. So I think the action animation is done extremely well. They don't steal the movie by any means, but they definitely accomplish what they're supposed to. And again, the movement of characters' bodies, which also go into action, done extremely well. In particular, also you can go with action when you talk about the musical numbers and the dances, and there's this great flow to it. Nothing feels robotic. As far as the dance scenes, everything feels organic and flows wonderfully. So, like I said, the action animation, whether it be actual action or like sort of musical action, dance numbers, that stuff, all of it flows organically and all of it's done really, really well. And then we have backgrounds and special effects, and there's a lot of, I think, great backgrounds that they use. I love the different locations. Because, you know, you have the big locations, you have the big landscapes of Paris and of Germany and of Russia, but then you have the little places in there, and they do a great job of showcasing all these little different places throughout these cities that they go to. So the locations, I think, are done very well. The backgrounds, you know, the backgrounds have their own beauty. Don Bluth backgrounds have their own unique style. At this time, I think that Disney background artists were better than his, but by no means it means that these were lacking any form. Because they are beautiful, and I think they did a great job of capturing the scenic beauty of whether it be St. Petersburg, Russia, or Paris, France, or even Germany, or Poland. I thought they did a great job of capturing the scenic beauty in the backgrounds. And then the special effects, the snow, the rain, the shadows, everything, really, you know, done basically perfection. Could not find anything out of place, nothing that really jumped out to me anyways. You really kind of forget about special, like I said, when you get sense to forget about the special effects. Again, that's also in the case of a good movie because it's keeping your attention. But looking back on it, special effects done extremely well and really fit with what they were doing with the movie. So, that is it for at least this part of the episode. It's time to take a break and for me to play a couple promos for you of people you should be listening to because, goddammit, I think I've been speaking for about 20 minutes. So I need a drink. So I'm going to play a couple promos for you guys, and when we come back, we're going to get into acting and it's a story. So I'll be right back, folks. After these messages, we'll be right back.
Superman.
Captain Marvel.
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariel.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear Man.
The Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents...
And many, many more.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January only at twotruefreaks.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going up!
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, Dad.
We need to record another new trailer.
Another one?
Yes. You know that we read comics and then talk about comics, because as we've established, talking about comics you've not read is just dumb.
Yeah, and you make me do it every Thursday.
Well, we've moved.
Have we?
Yes, we have outgrown our old location.
I don't feel like I've moved.
And we have now moved to twotruefreaks.com.
What was that again?
twotruefreaks.com. Hey, Kids Comics, still every Thursday at twotruefreaks.com.
And welcome back, and I hope you enjoyed your break, as I did. Got something to drink, and we're ready to jump right back in with acting, which of course means it's time to go over our cast list. We have Meg Ryan as Anastasia, with Kirsten Dunst portraying the younger version in the beginning of the movie, with Lacey Chabert and Liz Calloway providing the singing voices. John Cusack as Dimitri. Kelsey Grammer as Vladimir Ivanovich. Christopher Lloyd as the evil Rasputin, with Jim Cummings, as mentioned earlier, providing the singing voice. Hank Azaria as Bartok. And Angela Lansbury as the Empress Marie. This is one of those things to where, again, we go back to Scott McNeil's, how many names can we put on the box? It's a horrible Scott McNeil impression. Anyways, this is one of those instances, though, where I have to disagree with the how many names can we put on the box being a bad thing. And this is really why I talk about it a lot and what I try to talk about. The reason so often how many names can we put on the box is bad, as we've made mentioned, is that it's just a check for some of these people. And they don't put really any effort into it, whereas if they would have used actual voice actors, say a Scott McNeil, they would get a much better performance and a lot more emotion into these characters. But here, you get that. You know, they got some serious actors who portrayed the characters as serious, and they did a great job portraying it, and you felt the emotion in these characters, which is, again, why the movie works. And mind you, not all of these are just straight-up actors that they brought in because of their name. I mean, Kelsey Grammer done voice work. Christopher Lloyd did voice work. Hank Azaria. Hank Azaria. It's fucking from The Simpsons, man. And Angela Lansbury has done voice work. You know, and mind you, they brought her in for a very specific role that she was perfect for. Kind of just like Mrs. Potts was. Going down the list, Meg Ryan did a great job. She did a great job of providing this feisty energy to the character that really made the character work on a vocal level. I thought it was done extremely well. And as like mentioned, Kirsten Dunst, you know, did a great job on her one or two lines, portraying sort of the kid in those scenes. I mean, Kirsten Dunst is voicing the character for all about 5 minutes, really. But like I said, Meg Ryan did a great job. And there's a soulfulness to what she gave the character. She did a great job of providing a soul to Anastasia that really makes the character stand out as something other than just a Disney knockoff. You know, Anastasia as a prince, you know, alternate to the Disney princesses movie, stands out as something different. She's not just a Disney knockoff. She's something on her own. And part of that credit has to be given to Meg Ryan because of the voice she provided, I think. I thought John Cusack did a great job as Dimitri, as that sort of, not swab, Vivian Argyle, but just as that con, you know, he really fit the title of his character. His character was a con artist. He was a con artist that, trying to get ahead in life, trying to get out of Russia, you know, but I think John Cusack's shiny moments was what he gave the Dimitri character at the end of the film. There's this whole idea of, yes, he's in love with, you know, Anastasia, mind you. But there's also something else. When he hears that, you know, the door, there's a sort of a patriotic pride that he has. Like, this is my duty. I can't take this money. Yes, I love her, but it's also because my patriotic duty. And I'm willing to walk away from her forever because my duty to my country is done. Which I don't think a lot of people get as the president of his character. Yes, it's that whole, let's call it what it is. Dimitri is Aladdin. That's his character. He's the urchin street rat with that honor code, that pride for his city, or in this case, pride for his country. In this case, somebody who defended the princess when she was young, unknowingly defending her on the journey, and when he realizes that it is her, like, I can't take the money, I've done my job. And John Cusack, the sort of subtlety and, like, how important was it for, like, the Dustin to really understand this was Anastasia, and, you know, those sort of more quiet scenes as opposed to, and mind you, he was good in his earlier scenes as that sort of sneaky little con artist. Sometimes, you know, as Vladimir was, you know, in particular when you think about the, you know, the scene where on the bridge and Vladimir's like, he's talking and he's convincing Anastasia. It's like, so, what do you remember about your family? It's like, what? It's like, okay. I thought he did a great job with the character and definitely provided a unique voice for the character. Kelsey Grammer did a great job as Vladimir, as the comic relief of the trio on their journey. Kelsey Grammer has done some great stuff, and no different here. Fully understood what the role was, and he just put a lot of emotion, and you could feel the emotion, just the, you know, I think my favorite scene is when he's dancing around because he's like, oh my Ferris, I'm almost here. And it's like, but you feel the emotion coming from the voice. Again, something I'll be saying over and over again, you feel the emotion coming, you know, in the voice. And you definitely feel it from all of these actors. So, he did a great job. I don't like saying he's a comic relief. He was part of it. Kind of like Hank Azaria was part of it. But there was also a lot of serious parts that he had some great movement for the story that his character provided going forward. And Kelsey Grammer did a great job in providing that. Christopher fucking Lloyd as Rasputin is awesome. Because it's Christopher... It's not quite as awesome as his Judge Doom villain. I mean, Judge Doom may be one of the greatest goddamn motherfucking villains of all motherfucking time. Speaking of ghettoizing. But Christopher Lloyd does a wonderful job here. I love the little Russian accent that he gives there. All the little Russian accents, and by the way, all the characters give here. I guess that's the one criticism of it, is that you have all these characters doing accents and everything. Even Hank Azaria is giving a little accent there. But John Cusack, Meg Ryan, and Angela, I guess that's the one fault in their acting, is they're great actors, but I guess they couldn't do a good Russian accent. So it hurts them. But again, I think the more important part is the emotion. I would have loved to see him do accents. I think it could have made the film better. Then again, I guess the film did get enough bad press for being horrible about Russia. You know, there are always people like, oh, this is like, it's a, oh, this is completely butcherizing Russian history. I'm like, it's a fucking kids film, you dickwad. It's fantasy. Let it go. Fuck. Let it go. Let it go. Doesn't take it anymore. I hate that song. I hate this song. I hate this song. I hate this song. Fuck you. 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 Again, I point to earlier talking about the director apologizing for that song. You see what it does to people. I'm calm. I'm relaxed. Back to Christopher Lloyd. So I think the point I was trying to make was I really enjoyed the little Russian accent that he gave to Rasputin, and sort of the very rascally voice they did with it was great. The scenes in which Rasputin is losing his godforsaken motherfucking mind are beautifully acted. It's so over the top that it's great. And of course, that brings us to Hank Azaria, which is sort of, he's the straight man. There's this great sort of comedic timing and relationship between the two characters. And Bartok, Hank Azaria gets that timing down wonderfully. And it's just this great, unique voice. You know, again, the wow. I mean, I said wow. This thing to where Bartok will say something and he'll say like, and I said this, you know, he'll say something and says like, hooray, I say hooray, I can't believe, like, and I don't know about this, sir, and I'll give her a kick and a clap and a hi-ya. Like, I can honestly say because of this performance, I got very much excited for Hank Azaria in Godzilla. I have to laugh at myself now. Oh, I'm a sad, sad, sad man. And I did like him in that movie, too. Hank Azaria was one of the best parts of the Godzilla movie, mind you. Had some of the best lines in that goddamn movie. And yes, yes, I still have my thoughts on that movie. It's a horrible Godzilla movie. It's still a good giant monster movie. Anyways, he does a great job as the comedic relief. I mean, obviously he did a great job. He somehow apparently stole the movie and convinced people to do a freaking prequel movie starring him and I guess his relationships and everything. And Kelsey Grammer was in that one too. It's like, fucking wrong with you, Payball? Ah! Just do a sequel and tell them about going. Why couldn't they do a sequel and show Anastasia and Dimitri going to fucking New York? Anyways, I don't think I have to say much about Angela Lansbury's performance as the Empress, because it's Angela Lansbury. Obviously, they saw the character as, she's like Angela Lansbury. Hey, let's get Angela Lansbury. All right, we'll get Angela Lansbury. But it works here, and she does a great job. And again, she brings out emotion. She emotes. I can't talk about this enough. I don't think people understand this. There's so many people, they get a voice acting role, these big actors, and they think, oh, well, it's just my voice. I don't have to emote. Yes, you do. That's the reason why some of the best voice actors, they're really acting out in there. Ask Scott McNeil. He's really active in the booth because he's really acting out. Why? Because he fucking emotes. And Angela Lansbury does that here. She emotes. So, all in all, I thought the voice cast was great. I thought they did a great job. Which brings us to, last but not least, story. Now, the main plot of the film, very simple. Anastasia and Grandma get separated because of the Russian Revolution, because of this curse brought on by Rasputin, who goes to the icy grave. But basically, when it's when she gets back to the palace, it awakens the evil liquid magic thingamadang, which goes back to Rasputin, basically revealing that one Romanov is still alive. Of course, she doesn't know that she's Romanov. And a whole journey, as I said, she meets up with Dmitri and Ved. They think that she's a great lookalike, that they can teach her enough to make the Empress think that she is Anastasia. She doesn't know where she's from, and she's willing to go on this journey to find out about her past. Of course, as the movie goes along, we're given hints, and of course, a big one that basically reveals, yes, she is indeed the lost daughter Anastasia because of what she remembers. Of course, Rasputin is trying, in that sense, it's simple. It's the classic, the lost princess who has had amnesia and she's trying to find a way back to both her family and her memories. There's the sort of the buddy aspect of it, the buddy journey in the main plot. So there's all these little different little aspects that combine in the story that make it really interesting. As far as the main plot is concerned, I thought, and we'll talk about this with musical in a couple minutes, that they really stayed on point, and again, it moved at a nice pace. This film had a really great pace, which, by the way, that's something I haven't talked about in a while, is pace of a film. But I thought it did a great job with the pace. But the big thing here is also the theme. And I kind of hinted at to what it was before. And it might seem strange, people, to what I think the theme is for this movie. I'm going to say two words before all of you start singing. Listen to the entire sentence. I will jump through this computer and slap the taste out of your mouth. I think the theme is letting go of the past. Good, good. None of you started singing. I thought I might have to slap a bitch. Anyways, I really thought that, the theme of it, as strange as it may be, considering how much they're talking about finding it and reliving their past, that the theme is letting go of the past. And my reasoning for this is very simple. Yes, while Anastasia's journey is to rediscover her past, at the end of it, she understands that she can't be held down by her past, whether she remembers it or not, and ultimately follows her heart and goes off to love Dmitri and goes off on her journey. In a way, because she's letting go of her past, she's allowed to live. The Empress, you see how much the toll of not letting go of the past, not being able to find Anastasia, has taken on the Empress physically by the fact that she now walks with a cane. You know, Rasputin is not able to let go of being thrown out of the palace by the Romanovs. And Zwon sells his soul because of that, to the point to where he can't rest in peace because one Romanov is life, and he can't let go of the past until every last Romanov is dead. And now, so he's undead because of that, because he can't let go of the past. It's actually very subtle and very smartly interweaved into the film. It's this very interesting thing to where I don't think it's muddled. It's just that it's very smartly put. And unless you're really, again, it's a Don Bluth film, you have to pay attention to really sometimes get the moral, because that's what you should be doing for every film. But it's this great little ingenious thing to where they're actually talking about remembering the past, so you'll understand that the lesson is to let go of it. She's journeying back to the past to try to regain her memories. But at the same point in time, the lesson she ultimately learns is, okay, so now I know my past. How does it change me? Well, it didn't. I'm still the same person I am. I have to let go of the past because the past doesn't define me. The here and now defines me. That's the lesson that Anastasia ultimately learns. That's the ultimate moral of the story. It's what leads her to, you know, and again, it's best said in that little speech about, you know, at the end when, you know, they're at the ball and Anastasia in the curtain, she's like, should I go out? Should I go out? Should I go out? And her grandmother comes like, I don't think you're suited for this. Yes, we will always have each other, and I'm so glad that now I know that you're alive. But basically, I never meant for you to be trapped in this if this is not what you desire. Again, I dare say to follow your heart. But at the same point in time, the reason she can follow her heart is because she's willing to let go of the past. It's a very smart little moral that isn't actually told much. And, you know, really, in today's world, we could do with a lot of letting go of the past. I mean, you look at the riots because of the police brutality and everything, and a lot of that has to do with both sides, whether it be white people or black people, not letting go of the past. There are a lot of people that still won't let go of past sentiments that happened in the 60s and the 50s and in the Civil War and everything. You know, you look at a lot of Southerners. People weren't even alive during the Civil War, and yet they hold resentment towards the government because of what they did after the Civil War. And they don't trust the government because of that. Because they won't let go of the past. You know, it's a great moral that unfortunately I think isn't followed enough. You have to be willing to forgive, basically, is the lesson. You know, you don't forget, but you forgive. And you let go of the past controlling your life. A lot of people these days don't do that. And because of that, this is actually a very smart moral. I think my one criticism of it is that I think they could have showcased it a bit more. Because it's hidden well, but maybe hidden a bit too well. I had to really think about it for a second before it really dawned, like, this is the moral. Like, what was the moral of this story? Like, wait a minute. And I started thinking about the scenes. I'm like, well, that's the moral. That being said, it's a great moral. And the way they smartly interweave it, it's beautifully and smartly done. I just think they hit it a bit too well, maybe. Another thing I think that also worked with this is, again, this is a princess story. It's a romantic story. There is a boy meets girl, boy and girl fall in love, but, you know, all the things that go with it. But again, it's not the instance, and this is something also, again, I'll talk about. Whenever I hear somebody bash on these stories, all like, oh, this has been done before and all this and blah, 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 blah. When they actually talk like, oh, like, because they're so, these characters are so boring and the way they're acted is so boring in the story. So it's not really the story as much as it is the characters and that they didn't do a great job of executing believable and unique characters. So in that turn, when you get a movie like this that does have unique characters, you know, Anastasia's character is very unique. She's feisty and strong-willed and independent and smart-witted. Just because she doesn't know better and that she's lost her memory doesn't make her stupid. She's very smart-witted and, again, able to match wits with Dimitri and everything. And they're young people and, you know, they start, you know, as they're around, they start to fall in love and everything. You know, that whole thing of, you know, you have to hate somebody before you fall in love with them. So all those romantic aspects, yes, well, have been done plenty of times, work here because the characters are executed wonderfully. And again, the princess, you know, again, you really do, I mean, they really don't hide that much that Anya is Anastasia. It's pretty obvious when you first see her in her adult form. It's goddamn that the princess. And even though they drop hints throughout the movie, but pretty much fair. I mean, called Anastasia. You figure, especially being a kid's movie, they're not going to do like they did in the 1958 movie. That being said, that whole idea of the lost princess, you know. Again, that cry, like, oh my god, she's... What's this, a tale, dare I say, as old as time? Of, you know, the princess who doesn't know she's a princess and finds out that she really is a princess. And, you know, she comes and it somehow saves the kingdom. And so it's a story that's definitely been told before. But again, the execution of the character that makes her believable, makes her sympathetic, makes you care for her story, makes that princess aspect work. So these two elements definitely do help the story because it's not because they don't feel redone. They feel fresh because of the execution of the characters and their interactions with each other. And then, of course, you come to the musical part of it. And again, the story being told through the musical. The musical numbers tell certain aspects that just roll off each other and work very well. Wow, I thought I'd have more to say about this. I guess I feel like I've said all that I said pretty much when we talked the song. But again, it's a thing to where, with the musical numbers, they tell a story and it moves the story forward. You know, each has its own part to play. You know, you like I said, Rumor in St. Petersburg tells, you know, like, here's a rumor that happened in the past. Could it be true? It's legend. But could it be true? So. Have you heard there's a rumor in St. Petersburg? Have you heard there's a rumor? The greatest god in history! Again, this is another one of those musicals that, like, I'll start singing the song, and like, I'll start singing the songs. I'll stop now. But, you know, you have that. Then you have Journey to the Past. You know, like, I know somewhere out there there's an answer to the past that I've been missing. Once Upon a December delves into those memories. I remember long ago being with a family. Then, you know, again, that leads ultimately to, you know, I mean, Dimitri, and that story is continued. And then you have, like, I don't know. You had me believing that it could be Anastasia, but I have no memory. So basically, how can I convince somebody that I'm Anastasia? Well, we'll teach, because if I can learn to do it, you can learn to do it. If I can learn to, you know, it's listening to it. Which, again, has a very... There's a very familiarity to the song. The same way Howard Ashman would do familiarity in his song that makes the song work. And that tells the story of, you know, relearning your past. Perry will unlock the keys to your heart, you know, is the love song. And, you know, each song works well and tells a certain part of the story that's needed for the story. And again, it's executed well, and it fits along with the story. Nothing feels wanky or out of place or gullible or cheesy or anything. As cheesy as this story can be, it's executed with great refinement that makes it fun to watch, and especially for a hopeless romantic like me, done extremely well. Then you have the comedy. There's a lot, again, another thing that great comedy always helps a serious film and serious storylines, and this is one of them. One of the best comedy aspects of this movie is the back and forth between Anastasia and Dimitri's character. You know, there's a great joke that down the train scene to where you're seeing this back and forth, and Anastasia wins again. And then Zlatan, you know, he's basically keeping score of how many times basically Anastasia has bested Dimitri in verbal combat. I love that little joke. Vod has his funny moments. Every character has their individual funny moments that really work and really make the characters lovable. And that's the thing. It's like you fall... exception of Rasputin and his funny moment, because he's evil and there's nothing that's going to make him lovable. You're hating the villain, but but there's a bit of silliness that makes you laugh at him, like, oh, he, and it's a bit over the top, but that works for the character. But all the other characters, again, their funny parts make them, you know, even Bartok, you know, he's the sidekick, you know, he is Hank Azaria just nails lies, like, you know, blood pressure, it's a killer, sir. You know, I had a cousin Freddy just killed over. And it's like, I wonder if his attention was to do a Fargo voice with Bartok. Because that's what it seems like he was doing. Like, don't you know? Well, wasn't that strange, don't you know? But like, just killed over one day, sir. Dead as a doornail. Well, and he's a fruit bat, sir. No meat. No blood, even. It's like, God damn. That's why you're making me laugh so hard. It's like, one of my favorite scenes with Bartok is, you know, it's like, a party. Oh, that's right, sir. A party. And a little dance. I can teach you the latest dance move. It goes with a whoosh and a host. And then you get wild with the hips, sir. It's like, yes, we'll have him party. Have his fun. And then we'll kill her. Skate it to pieces. And the picture portrait lands on Bartok, like, and we're back to the killing. Please, sir. I'm telling you. Why this is all making me laugh? I don't know. Then again, this is my prerogative, so why the hell do I care? But I think it's very smart comedy. It really is. It's silly, but smartly done. Like I said, you have the verbal back and forth between Anastasia and Dimitri that creates great comedy moments. Vlad provides a lot of great physical comedy, you know. The fat guy, you know, he's trying to, like, it won't turn! Turn harder! It won't turn! As he's like, which makes him sound like he's, Bubba, Jeff Dunham's puppet Bubba, going, make it a left turn! You know, he's like, Vlad, help me with this! And he falls over and he falls in some type of crate. It's like, where's Vlad? Vlad's disposed at the moment. Comedy moments, like, you know, there's so many little great little comedy moments on that little train scene right there. The whole point, give me a wrench, give me something. Not working, give me something else. Gives a dynamite. It's like, that'll work. Which, by the way, leads me to have to sit here and say this. I'm watching them, like, in honor of TWK. Boom goes the dynamite. So there's a lot of great little, I think, smartly done comedy in this film that really helps it along again, gives it a lovely little charm. So at the end of the day, like I said, I really think that Anastasia is one of Don Bluth's best films he's ever done. It's right up there with Secret of Nim. It's right up there with American Tales. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of love put into these characters. I think it's really sad I don't think any fault Don Bluth and Gary Goldman and the animators, because, like I said, I also think Titan A.E. was a... It's actually a very underrated film. That being said, again, this is more of the fault of Fox. But anyways, it's sad that this is one of his last films, because this film is damn near ingenious, and it's a great view of what maybe Don Bluth would have done if he had stayed with Disney. If he was still with Disney when they got to the 90s era, and they started doing the princess movies. Because this is a damn good princess movie. So, you know, you have great songs. They're solid. That flow with each other and tell a cohesive musical story. Very solid, beautiful looking animation. A voice cast that just a great... That provides a lot of emotion and makes their characters very believable. And a story that's smartly done with a moral tale and comedy that's all smartly done. It's the perfect recipe for a great animated movie. There's some small things here and there that I could probably nitpick on. And by no means it's the perfect movie. But this... It's just a great, solid, wonderful movie that I always have a joy of watching. So I give Anastasia a 4.5 out of 5. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed my review of Anastasia. If you have any emails or comments or anything you want to leave the show, remember there are separate ways you can contact the show. One, you can contact the show by emailing us at appsolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's appsolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on both Stitcher and Facebook by going to them. Those sites, going to Stitcher.com and Facebook.com and searching for the Absolution Network. Like us and leave us a comment there. And you can always leave a comment on the website itself on this post by searching for this episode on www.an.132productions.com. You also make sure that you check out all the other 132 Productions content that, of course, includes Shin Tiger Kuro and his videos on wrestling and anime, along with John Ramos' videos on Super Sentai. There's CMJU's wrestling reviews, Tom's Top 10, and, of course, the Internet Graphic Review. All on right here on the Absolution Network. There's also, make sure you can go to my Comic Book Crazy Podcasting Network, where you can find the Comic Book Crazy Podcast, Hexcast, and we podcast and reviews every issue of Jim Miller's Zero Witch, the Black Rose, and Spectacular Webs. You can find that at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, my Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. Also, while you're there, check out our sidebar with many of our friends on the sidebar of the site that do great stuff, as I promoted before. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey and Views from Long Box, along with From Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Spidey Dude and the Clone Saga Chronicles podcast. Great stuff. Steven Schleicher and a major Swole's podcast, and of course Sky Gunner and the Two Freaks Podcasting Network. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week is Christmas, or at least this weekend is the last weekend before Christmas, and I want to do something special, something unique. So for the first time, and mind you, we have reviewed something like this, but there was enough animation in it. I mean, we're going to review something similar to that next year as well. I plan to. I'm, of course, talking about Who Framed Roger Rabbit. My point is that I'm going to review a live-action film next episode. that has some animation in it, but it's little animation. And I'll get to it, but it's what I'm getting at, because basically I reviewed Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is a live-action film, but has tons of animation in it. The film that I'm going to review is not like that, but again, part of this podcast is also memory lane and that stuff. And, you know, recently I was minded of a film that I don't think a lot of young people remember. I'm apparently just old enough to remember it. It's something from my childhood I remember watching. I recently refound it, and it's something I always wanted to review. So as a very special Christmas edition of Tom's Prerogative, I'm going to review March of the Little Wooden Soldiers, starring Laurel and Hardy. We're getting really old school for this one, folks. I hope you enjoy it. I know I'm enjoying it. I'm going to enjoy watching it again. So, you know what, I'm getting ready to march off and watch this movie. So next week, March of the Little Wooden Soldiers, starring Laurel and Hardy. So until next time, my Tsunami Generation.
Find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous.
Stay gold.
Desert. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off, and until we meet again, you know the rest.